This is Steve Maxner, and I'm continuing the interview with Mr. Bill Paris on the 19th of November 2003, approximately 9:40 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Paris is in Piedmont, South Dakota. Sir, why don't we go ahead and pick up with our discussion of the time in between your first and second tours, and if you would, describe what it was like coming back to the United States and how you felt.
Sure. It was the first time I really was, quote, back in the United States since I left for Korea in 1962. And by that, I mean it was the first time I really had a chance to be out and about. When I came back the other time, I was in Officer Candidate School and then 4 months at a basic training center, and I never really got a chance to get out and experience life in these United States, if you will, to steal a phrase from Reader's Digest magazine. What I noticed when I got back was that everything had changed, and it was very stark, and I felt quite alienated, not only from my combat experiences and having served in Vietnam, which was in 1968, was getting to be, the Gulf had pretty much formed in this country between the hawks and the doves and the who gives a shit. But so many things had changed anyway. Music had changed, dress had changed, sexual mores had changed. I ended up at Fort Benning, Georgia, which was probably no different. I don't know what to compare it to, but when I left the United States in 1962, single people weren't particularly having a lot of sex. It was going on somewhere, I'm sure, but young people in particular weren't indulging in it like they were when I got back. It was quite a revelation to me. And then, of course, going back to a stateside Army base, particularly one that had just deployed a division a couple of years before, Fort Benning is the home of the infantry school, and so all infantry soldiers are there, either training up initially, officers, and enlisted. There was a basic training contingent. There was the airborne school, the ranger school, the officer basic course, the officer advanced course, the non-commissioned officer course, which we call the instant E6, shake and bake. Take these kids and, you know, they have pretty high IQs. And instead of running them into officer candidate school, they'd run them into the instant non-commissioned officer course, because we had gone through pretty much the infantry non-commissioned officer cadre. We'd run them through Vietnam almost twice by that time. And we were in desperate shape for non-commissioned officers. So we take these kids out of advanced infantry training. We put them in for 6 weeks of intense training, and the top 20% came out as Staff Sergeant E6s. The next 40% were Sergeant E5s, and then the remainder were Specialist 4th Class. So the Army was doing this to fill the ranks up with not experienced NCOs, but at least people who had some idea of what was going on in leadership. So there's all this intensity there at Fort Benning, and people are stressed. And I mean, you could cut that stress with a chainsaw. Those of us who had already been to Vietnam once, particularly if you had a reserve commission like I did, you were going back, and you were going back soon, real quick, like within a year. The regular Army commissioned officers, they knew they were going back anyway, probably not right away. So there's that specter hanging over your head, and it influenced everything we did. We drank an awful lot. we screwed an awful lot. We did pretty much what people under stress do, which is sort of kind of laugh in the face of adversity and wish to hell you were somewhere else where it wasn't happening quite like that. I ended up on the leadership committee at Fort Benning. I instructed non-commissioned officer classes, officer basic course, and officer candidate school classes, all in leadership. It was an enjoyable period, but I had decided after my association with the pilots that I had become very close with in Vietnam. I resurrected the flight school thing, and so I took the commissioned officer flight aptitude selection test, passed that, and I left after about, 5.5 months to go to flight school. Got promoted to captain en route, went to flight school, got married to my current wife, went through 9 months of flight school, and then hit a wall there on reassignment that Vietnam was full of aviators. Interesting experience. You spend 9 months, because we were all TDY at flight school, essentially from Vietnam. It's an administrative thing. They assigned us to, like, second field forces in Vietnam, and then when you went to flight school. So even though you didn't draw combat pay and all that, you essentially were on temporary duty all the way through flight school, which was good money. But then when we got out and we graduated, we got our orders. And I got orders for Fort Benning, Georgia, and I called Fort Benning, and they were at triple strength on pilots. People were fighting to get flight time, and I thought, well, two things. Number one, here I am, a new pilot, and I'm going to stand in line. I'm going to be about the 25th captain trying to get flight time, and there'll be nothing to do, and then I'll hang around, get comfortable, and they'll yank my butt back to Vietnam. The other thing was that... due to a personal relationship that I had had, I really didn't want to go back to Fort Benning with a new wife. So, being me, I finagled my way around. I think I may have told the story at the end of the last interview. I'm not sure, Steve.
What's that?
I'm not sure if I told that story about going to instructor pilot school.
I don't recall.
Okay, well, it's...
Go ahead and tell it.
Okay, well, what happened was, I was facing some real discomfort having to go back to Fort Benning, which I had just left with an ex-girlfriend. And so, besides which, I wanted to go to Vietnam and get the second tour over with. I was just newly married. There's no point in having this hanging over our heads, because I also knew if I didn't go right away, I may not have gone. I mean, it was just, there's all this life suddenly that you're enjoying, and then the idea of going over to that charnel house over in Vietnam, you better get going while you got the attitude to do it. So I called the infantry branch, and before, when I called them a couple weeks before that, and of course, infantry branch at that time was the largest branch in the Army. There are like 30 officers up there managing every infantry officer in the world. In the entire United States Army, which at that time was right at 900,000 people. And I had called up the infantry branch before, and they said, tough, you're going to Fort Benning, life's a bitch, and then you die. One of those conversations. So having talked to enough of my pilot friends, I knew that being an aviator, and I also knew that my records had been shipped and had been moved in infantry branch over to the aviation section. So I called Branch back up, and I asked to talk to not the infantry assignments officer, but the infantry aviator assignments officer. And that's a whole different class of people. So I get this warrant officer on the phone, and I tell him, Chief, I've been back for over a year, and I'm thinking seriously about I might as well go ahead back over. What do you have in the way of school? So always Cobras was open. They always had gunships open. Well, I didn't want to be a gunship pilot. I mean, that was kind of like driving a truck around at 1,500 feet, and that didn't appeal to me at all. So I said, well, what do you have in the scout aircraft? I want to fly the 086, which was the current scout in the Army inventory at the time. And that's the Hughes 500 civilian. That's what they call it. So he said, no, we don't have any more of those. He said, we're bringing this brand-new helicopter in, the OH-58, the Bell Jet Ranger. And if you'd like, I've got an IP. The very first IP class in the country is filling up at Rucker in about 5 weeks. if you want to go to that, then you'll go right to Vietnam. And I said, fine. So I didn't tell him I was a brand new pilot.
Mm-hmm.
didn't even have the protective sheen off of my wings yet.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, fine, give me your statistics and I'll cut the orders. And I thought, hey, if it's fine with him, it's fine with me.
Oh, that's amazing.
So I went back home. I told my wife, hey, I'm going to IP school in the 58th. And she looked at me because she had worked for the Air Force for 2.5 years,
mm-hmm.
hung around with a lot of pilots. And she said, how the hell do you get to go to IP school? And I said, look, they're not asking, and I'm not saying. Okay, so I get my orders. Sure enough, it's class number one, down at Fort Rucker. And I was still a sedan at the time, so I did my my snowbird time at the education center working for my wife for about 3.5 weeks, getting a little flight time out here, there, and everywhere. And then I went down to IP school. When I got down to IP school, here are all these captains and warrants who've been in Army Aviation for a while. They've all got anywhere from 1,500 to 5,000 hours of flying time. I show up with 240 hours. This W-4, there were 12 of us in this class. They break us down like there are 6 instructors, I think. Or no, there were 4 instructors and each had 3 students. The W-4 calls me off to the side in a rather gruff voice. He wasn't even friendly about it. He said, what the hell are you doing in my school? And I said, what do you mean, Chief? And he said, Captain, I just looked at your flight records. Are you telling me you just graduated from flight school and you're in IP school? And I kind of looked at him. I said, yeah. He said, well, I tell you what. I'm calling infantry branch. You're going back to wherever the hell it is you're going. You have no business being here. You don't even know the first thing about flying. You know, I need seasoned pilots here in the school. I don't need you, rookie. So my whole life flashed in front of my eyes, and I thought, ah, hell, here we go. Because if infantry branch finds out that I hoodwinked them, I'm going to be up a one-man recon up to an Arctic Circle for about 5 years. So I got the chief off to the side, and I said, for God's sake, would you please listen to me for a minute? So I explained to him what my real problem was. And I could see, as soon as I mentioned that, you know, this would really cause lots of problems in so many areas, personal as well as professional, I could see him kind of melting a little bit, and he said, so if I send you back to the Army, they're going to send you to Fort Benning, you're going to get divorced? And I said, well, that's probably about it. So he said, okay, I'll tell you what, Captain. He said, I'm going to let you stay in my course. But he said, I'm going to ride you harder than any other pilot. And he said, if you so much as twitch the wrong way while we're up in that aircraft, he said, I'm going to wash you out of this program, and I don't care what the hell goes on. So he kept me in there. And for the next month, I was a pretty good pilot. I mean, given the fact that, yeah, I didn't have a lot of hours, but I had flown a lot with the guys in Vietnam, and I was a little bit older. You know, I think I was 27 at the time. So I was a little steadier on the stick, not quite so quick to react and then think later. And I made it through the course. I did pretty well. And left right away for Vietnam. I had orders for a delay en route of 30 days, which was normal. You got your 30-day leave before you went to Vietnam. My wife and I, because back then officers and enlisted men had to request permission to leave the country. So if you want to go, like, say, down to the Caribbean, you had to contact branch, and they had to approve it. So my wife and I wanted to go to the Bahamas before I left as sort of a honeymoon. We'd never had one. We were going to miss our first anniversary because I was going to be in Vietnam. So we went down to the Bahamas, and We were there about, I don't know, 3 days, and it was just horrible. We enjoyed ourselves, but, you know damn good and well what's going to happen. You've got to come back and face it. So finally, one night we were sitting out on, I don't know, this thing, looking at this beautiful beach, watching the sunset. We decided, to hell with it. Let's just get on with it. You know, this is nice, but let's just get this year over with. So what we did do is we went out the next day and bought 2 acres of property in the Bahamas. And we've still got them to this day. I don't know what they're worth, probably not much, because they're kind of out in the bush. But we went 2 years ago, went down, saw the property, still there. So we headed back to, flew back to Savannah, and I went off to Vietnam. And made that long-ass flight. And instead of going out to Japan, this time I left Travis, and we went up across the Arctic Circle through Alaska, and that knocks about 2 hours, 3 hours off the flight, which was nice because they're long. About 20, 21 hours in an airplane, which is a hell of a long time. Got to Vietnam and I noticed right away, things was different.
Bill, before we delve too deeply into that, let me ask you a couple of clarifying questions from what you've talked about in the interim, your interim period there. First, your time at Fort Benning with training at the NCO school, mm-hmm. NCO Academy, the Shake and Bake program.
Yeah.
How effective did you think that was?
I'd say so. Most of these guys, it's like, you know, having Officer Canada school. Most of these guys either have it or they don't. Most the things that you're teaching them are tricks and techniques, but you can't prepare these guys for what they're about to undergo. So, quite honestly, it was about as effective as what we were given to the OCS students, although I really did try. I tried very hard, but I don't know. To be honest with you, I have no idea how effective it was.
Do you think? Go ahead.
The things that they were going to face over there, and I didn't even know about it until I got back over on my second tour, these were things that no human being is equipped to deal with at that level.
Well, and what time frame was that where you were?
This was the summer and fall of 1968.
Okay.
And what I didn't realize was in that 15 months while I was gone, everything had changed over in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Everything.
Well, of course, I would imagine you were watching fairly closely from your various news sources here in the United States what was going on in Vietnam, or did you? Did you watch the news regularly, read the newspaper, keep up with what was happening in Vietnam?
Well, not really, because we were trying to get away from it.
Mm.
We'd had enough. I mean, sure, we watched the news, but, you know, in a sense, your life is not stable. I mean, I lived in a house with four guys. There were nonstop female traffic coming in and out, male traffic coming in and out. There'd be impromptu parties, you know, and you're trying to sleep, and so, you know, you end up staying up all night drinking when you ought to be sleeping. You know, it's not like you sit down and watch the news.
Mm.
You do. I mean, we did catch it, and we had newspapers, and of course we all read the Army Times because they were still printing the casualties. So we all wanted to keep up with who's who, but I mean, we knew what was going on in the war. Not much, just same old business, killing and dying. So it didn't take a whole bunch of monitoring.
Well, how did you find the news that you did watch? Did you find it credible?
No. No, it was all the same thing. It was even Walter Cronkite, who I had a tremendous amount of respect for, it was like they'd give the baseball scores. Example, today in the Republic of South Vietnam, three helicopters were shot down. There was fighting around the city of Yeta, in, you know, down near Can Tho. There was a joint U.S.-South Vietnamese operation, and there were 13 American casualties, stuff like that. So I suppose I could have read Time, or, you know, and once in a while I'd pick up a copy and look at it. But this was the era when, this particular time frame is when things started to really polarize. And the media went, you know, on the anti-war side primarily. Now, there was some, like the Columbus, Georgia city newspaper, that was very pro-military. And, of course, Charlie Black had gone over with the 1st Cavalry Division when they deployed from Columbus. And so the community, if you will, the community newspaper was very supportive of the war. And the people, because they had such close ties, but you get out and get away from that. You know, when I got home, my older sister and brother, who I dearly loved, you know, kind of looked at me and said, man, we got to get out of there. That's the wrong place to be, and it's just stupid. And I took it, like, real personal when they said things like that. What do you mean it's real stupid? You know, this is my own family. Hell, you think I've been wasting my time over there for a year? It's a little late for that, isn't it? So.
How old were they?
They were in their early 30s.
Okay.
And I was in my late 20s, 26, 27.
Did you, when you encounter people like that, especially close relatives, did you ever begin to question the war yourself? Did it have an effect on you and how you perceived it?
Not at that time, because I had just gotten back. And I felt like I'd done a good job, and I was very proud of it. And frankly, I was quite hurt by the reaction. It seemed to me to be a gross travesty for people to sit around and intellectually discuss this business when the visceral dying was going on over there. I mean, this is the conversation we should have had going into this, not during the middle of it. All you're doing is giving aid and comfort to the enemy, and believe me, they're watching. And we knew that.
Well, that brings up an interesting question then. Do you think that those issues were discussed enough before Americans became involved in Southeast Asia?
Absolutely not. It was, you know, that whole thing, the Kennedy and the Johnson administrations are like thing one and thing two. These well-intentioned people who had no idea what the hell they were getting into, who had skills in a lot of areas, but none of them had any foreign policy skill whatsoever. Kennedy was a complete child in the woods about, you know, the world. And Johnson wasn't much better. He was a superior local politician. The guy could run this country like nobody's business, but the problem was that we have to interact with the rest of the world. And, you know, and it just didn't interest him. He sort of reminds me of Clinton later on, you know, who didn't give a rat's ass till it came up to bite him. And then suddenly, you know, it was like, oh, well, I guess you got to pay attention to the other stuff, too. And Lyndon Johnson just slid into that whole thing, really wasn't watching what was going on, and was making dumb decisions, and then started into an over-control mode when it was way too late. It was like Eisenhower left in 60, and for 8 years we had all this fumbling around in the foreign policy area that was just pathetic. And we got taken advantage of any number of times, any number of ways, by our friends, by our enemies, by everybody. Well, that's my opinion.
Do you think that it's had a, I don't want to bring us forward too far and get off the subject of your second tour, but while we're on the subject of this, do you think that we've learned any lessons from that? And do you think today we're discussing our foreign policy enough before we actually become involved or embroiled in something? You know, you mentioned the Clinton administration, and I don't know if you're perhaps referencing Somalia or some other foreign policies, but of course, with the current war wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the wars against terrorism. I didn't know if you thought that the administration today, the Bush administration, had learned anything from those mistakes we made previously.
Well, they're they're vastly different scenarios. I think Kennedy and Johnson had no real business doing what they were doing in the foreign policy arena. Neither one of them really understood the world well enough to be there, number one. And then number two, they didn't listen to their friends, which at times is okay, but at other times that could cost you, and it cost us horribly. To respond to your question, I think that in the last, so let's take the last 10 years, I think that what the presidency of Bill Clinton faced was opportunities to avoid what's going on now, but it would have taken someone who had more insight into the world. We don't have many politicians who truly understand the world dynamics. They're very few and far between, and we tend to smother their voices with our need for, I don't want to say political correctness, because that's too smug and too narrow a definition. Americans don't think globally, and we don't do a good job of understanding what the needs of the rest of the world are. We tend to exist as this very affluent pocket in a world that is quite dynamic and has needs that we don't understand. And I think where we are today with the present administration is they're somewhat more prescient about that world, but unfortunately now the bill has come due, and I don't think we can retreat from what we're doing because we've gone too far. And now we have to take a stand for what we're doing, and it's ugly. It's ugly because you cannot do this in a communication format that Americans will understand. We're, as a nation, we've gotten very illiterate about the rest of the world, and to help people understand what's going on doesn't make any difference. We've been attacked everywhere, to include New York City. And now we've got to go in and do what we're doing. And we need to do a good job there. But I don't think people really understand the forces they're up against. And we're up against some bad dudes. And they're not backing off. God help us if we back off. Mm-hmm. We just can't take this on. It's really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So that's my nickel's worth.
I think it's important to get that kind of perspective because you were in the Vietnam War and you have that experience, and so you're looking at what's going on today in the United States through that prism, through those experiences. So.
And I'm seeing a lot of deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would say. Once again, we're messing around with stuff we really don't understand, and we're not willing to put down, sort of, if you will, the idea that we're a superior nation, and take a look at others through the prism of what they've got to have to survive. And they've got to have certain things, and we've got to quit playing with it. So,
okay.
Good enough.
A couple of other questions about your experiences in between your tours. In particular, you mentioned that, of course, you went through your pilot training and then through the instructor pilot training. How effective did you find that? What did you find most challenging, especially about your initial pilot training?
The most challenging thing was to flying a helicopter is, let me see if I can pull out some of the modern terminology. It's multitasking under pressure.
Okay.
It's very comfortable once you learn to do it, but unlike flying a fixed-wing aircraft where the pilot is kind of important on takeoffs and landings and the rest of it you can fake, with a helicopter you're constantly flying it. And I had flown fixed-wing when I was 15, 14 years old, I had never flown in a helicopter except in the back, and then once in a while the guys would let me hop up front in Vietnam. But I did not realize how physically busy you are in a helicopter. You're always busy. You never can just kick back, have a cigarette, put your feet up, and enjoy the flight. You're always flying. So it's that part is challenging. And then understanding the aerodynamics of a helicopter as opposed to a fixed-wing aircraft, that's a little tricky, too, because there are far different forces that you're playing with there. Overall, I didn't find flight school difficult. I found it was interesting, it was challenging, and I think it prepared me very well for what I was about to do. And I was a pretty good pilot when I came out. And I was a pretty good pilot all the way through until I lost interest in flying.
Now, what was it like transitioning from your training helicopter into, I assume you went first to the Huey transition?
Well, we flew the, when I went through the little trainers we started out on, I was on what they call the OH-23D,
okay.
The Raven, and that was a early 50s product. And now half of the class was on the newer Hughes, what they call the TH-55, and those things, that's literally a rotor strapped to your back. They're these tiny little aircraft, you can't believe two guys are going to get into them, but I've flew the older one, and they took a little bit of getting used to, because most aircraft by that time had what they call an articulated throttle, which means you just pulled up and down on the collective, and this little mechanical mechanism took care of the hard part of keeping sufficient fuel going to the engine. The OH-23s, you had to manually control that yourself, so you were doing a lot of things at once. And if you screwed up and you didn't put enough gas into that thing, and you pulled up on the collective and put some pitch on the blades, well, you know, you may suck off the power and fall out of the sky. So you kind of had to remember to do a lot of little things like that. But it was a fun aircraft to fly,
mm-hmm.
And just very nice, in auto rotations. Which is where you fall out of the sky, and what you do is an auto rotation simulates an engine failure,
mm-hmm.
And you just ride the helicopter blades down.
Okay.
And so and those are fun after you get used to it, because it's kind of like being on a roller coaster where they take you up and up and up and up and up, and you think, oh boy, this first one's going to be a doozy, and all of a sudden it hits the peak, and then you just fall. That's kind of what an auto rotation is. You just chop the power and drop the collective and you fall. Then when you get down to the bottom, you just pull the collective back in and put some pitch into the blades. And if you do it right, it cushions your landing, and you land very nicely and you step out to applause. Screw it up. Then you're going to crash.
Okay. Now, so what was it like transitioning into an aircraft like a Huey from the training aircraft?
Well, the Hueys, of course, were they were kind of the Cadillacs of the fleet. They were very nice helicopters. We used them for everything, and I didn't like them. I didn't like them because they were big, and they were, you know, it was that boring kind of flying. I'm more of the Chihuahua kind of a flyer. I like lots of action and running around barking. Hueys are too stable and
too predictable.
Too predictable. Too boring. I to be honest with you, I never flew the Huey well, and that was just because it was boring to me. And yet you talk to the guys who flew them, and they loved them, and they did all these wonderful things. And all the time I flew in the Hueys, I was thinking, boring. I like bugs on my teeth and leaves in my ears and woohoo.
Okay. Well, then that leads me to my next question about your decision to go to forego when you were approached initially or told initially about Cobras and gunships.
Yeah.
And instead go with the Bell Ranger.
Right.
As opposed to the Loach. I would imagine that flying a Cobra, flying a gunship into the heat of battle, would be a pretty exciting job. But you put it, I think you said it was like you didn't want to fly a truck at 1,500 feet.
Right.
So I guess perhaps my impression of what flying a Cobra might be like is a little bit misplaced, and I don't quite understand it.
Well, okay. I need to explain this answer because it has a lot to do with me and who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. Gunships can be very exciting, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But my perception of myself in war
mm-hmm.
is I've got to be in the mix. If we're going to have a scrum, then I've got to be in the middle of it. I don't want to be in the periphery of it.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, gunships, if they're smart, are going to stay at 1,500 to 2,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to go in and they're going to acquire and attack their target, and they're not going to get real low, although with that minigun, they're going to have to
mm-hmm.
get down at least at the 1,000-foot level and then back up and out.
Yeah.
I developed this thing, and it has to do with who I am exactly. Viscerally, this is Bill Paris. And I would always tell this to the gunship pilot.
Mm-hmm.
I like to see who I kill.
Hmm.
Killing is such a personal thing, and when you make it impersonal, it becomes too easy. And that's the way I feel about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't like to get so comfortable with the idea of war and violence and killing that I never forget that this is something awful that we're doing. And no matter the rectitude of it or, you know, it still is ugly business. And you can keep your perspective as long as it doesn't become like a holiday, like a video game. Because when you start treating it like a video game, then your humanity is at serious risk.
Well, you just keep bringing up some pretty interesting and deep subjects here, Bill.
Sorry.
So what? No, that's okay. If you were to look at some of the current technology and current tactics that we employ in war fighting, what do you think of that? Because you're looking at remote control killing.
I don't like it at all.
You can't get much more remote controlled than a Predator drone being remotely controlled by some guy in a truck a couple of hundred miles away and dropping a bomb on somebody or something using cameras.
Well, I tend to agree, and this is just me. I tend to agree with General George S. Patton, World War II general, not his son.
Mm-hmm.
He said that when war gets down to pushing buttons, that's not war. That's technology gone mad.
Hmm.
And, boy, it does. It covers so many issues, and there's a place for a Predator missile, I guess, but not always. I think that those who have the capability of taking a nation into war must know very clearly what war is and the price that is going to be paid. Because even Desert Storm, let's take a quickie little victory. There are a lot of guys wandering around, and I know this because we worked with some veterans from Desert Storm, were in a total fog. They're not sure they were even in a war. And yet there's a certain coterie of that veteran population who was over there
mm-hmm.
who very viscerally experienced it. I'm thinking of the tank battle they had at night And it was pretty horrifying for those guys. Now, they understand very clearly. A lot of the rest of them don't. They were, you know, thundering left, thundering right. No. And I think our political leaders are at great risk when they do not understand the concept of what they're about to unleash. Mm-hmm. And it's not an intellectual exercise.
Right. Okay. Sure, let me pause this for a moment.
Okay.
I'm going to have to change something in my equipment real quick. Just
you
a want second.
To call?
Oh, no, I just need a pause for a second.
Pause for the cause? No.
Pause. Okay. Go ahead, sir. We're back from our momentary break.
Our short and brief pause.
That's right. So, I'm sorry, go ahead, continue.
No, it's okay. I've lost track of where I was. So.
Okay. Well, you know, in terms of the changes that you witnessed as you came back to the United States, and just to touch for a few more minutes on the interregnum between your two tours, what...
Oh, I love it when you use those big words.
All right.
Okay,
that's all right. When you were back here in the United States, what you mentioned some of the social and cultural differences that you witnessed. what would you say was the most striking change that you witnessed during that time in the summer, spring and summer, I guess in fall of 1968? And in particular, address the political climate, if you will.
It was obvious to me that there was a great and powerful stirring throughout the land. There was huge changes in the wind, and boy, Bob Dylan had it right when he said, you know, when he sang his songs, I can't even remember what it was, but the times they are changing, that was it. They really were, and they had changed fast. And politically, I had the feeling that the old guard was uneasy because they had the Democratic Convention in Chicago right after I got back. And, of course, Martin Luther King had just been killed, and then during that, right before the convention, Bobby Kennedy got killed. And you could tell the people were floundering. The Democratic Party seemed to be not really in charge because it was real unpopular to own up to the war. All of their candidates kind of talked out of the side of their mouth, even Eugene McCarthy, who is a very strong anti-war candidate. You know, we've got to end this, we've got to get out. And then when they would push him and say, yeah, well, what are you going to do? Just get up and walk away. It'd be like, well, no, but, you know, we're going to get out. We're going to get out. So on one hand, the people that were supposedly in charge of this war were really not in charge anymore. You could tell. Johnson was quite isolated in the White House, picking targets for bombers. The Democratic Congress was totally at each other's throats. The Republicans weren't a factor in the House and the Senate except to get up and say, well, you know, you guys aren't doing too well here, are you? And there was, I honestly think it's during this period that spin becomes more than an art form. It becomes sort of entrenched in American politics because you would hear things coming out of people's mouths that just sounded so damn good. And then when you thought about it, it was in retrospect. And number one, he didn't really tell you much. And then number two, he's talking to what you want to hear. And the contrast to, say, someone like Eisenhower was phenomenal. Eisenhower was not a great speaker, but when he talked to you, it was kind of like your dad, you know, sit you down and say, all right. And he was always pretty honest with you. I mean, I remember when Eisenhower, that whole U2 thing, with Gary Powers, and Eisenhower stepped up to the plate and said, yeah, I did that. And then you had Kennedy, who was very eloquent and very charismatic and told you all these wonderful things, and gosh, it sounded good. Couldn't get a budget passed through his own Congress, but, gee, it sounded good. And Kennedy's always talking to you about, you look at him and you think, man, this guy's got it together. Then you watch what happens and nothing happens. And you think, whoa. And by the time Johnson's in the White House, they're doing an awful lot of what we now call spin control. A lot of yeah, but, and no, that's not really right. And having come from the Army in Vietnam and watching how they were putting things, pretty soon the non-message became everything. And the Air Force even had a joke that went around. It was a tape, very popular. I used to have a copy of it. Well, my wife did. And the whole thing was, it was purported to be an interview between a civilian reporter, an Air Force fighter pilot, and an Air Force PIO officer who is there to make sure that, they've got the right story. So the tape essentially is a series of direct questions. I understand that you're bombing cabbage patches up in Vietnam, in North Vietnam. Do you consider these likely targets as opposed to, military complexes? And then the fighter pilot would get on and say things like, yeah, well, bombing those goddamn cabbage patches, that's the target assigned to us by somebody a lot higher up than me. And I'll tell you, he's never flown a jet before. Or he'd know the flak was so thick. And then the PIO officer would interrupt and say, well, what the captain means is that oftentimes the difficulty of the mission is his biggest focal point, that the target selection happens at the appropriate command level. Well, it's spin doctoring in its early form, and this got to be so ingrained in our society. The military had to learn how to speak. Mm-hmm. Neil Sheehan covers this in his book, A Bright Shining Light. But what he leaves out in his book is that the press taught the military to do it, and the government encouraged it, and then finally demanded it, and then pretty soon the press was doing it. And so he had all these smartasses who were reporters sitting around at the 5 o'clock follies in Saigon sneering and yet passing on this crap from a military who had long since learned not to tell them the truth. So I think that's where we were. And politically, you could tell we were in serious trouble. Mm-hmm. And all the Democratic candidates for president were looking ugly. Hubert Humphrey, who really was a nice guy, Eugene McCarthy, who was not quite so nice guy, and he had the young people with him. Oh boy, let's get out of Vietnam. And then there was Nixon, who quite frankly said, well, sure, we can get out of Vietnam, but how you do it is much more important than if you do it, because it's obvious we're going to do it. And then he would say things like, I have a secret plan, which I think for those of us who were over the age of 18, we understood very clearly that, being Nixon, he'd get us out, but don't bug him with details. So, and I honestly think that with the total shambles the Democratic Party was in, that's why they lost the election. But even so, it was very close. Had George Wallace not run, we probably would have ended up with Hubert Humphrey and another well-intentioned man sitting in the White House, wringing his hands, going, gee, what do we do?
Well, in terms of that election and Nixon's secret plan to win the war, were you a Nixon supporter, or did you?
Absolutely. Because I began to see that obviously the mood of the country is such we ain't going to be there forever. And the only thing that Kennedy or Humphrey or Eugene McCarthy, any of these people could do, would be either to stampede out the door or pretend you weren't stampeding and running like hell anyway. And I knew if they did that, it would shatter the morale of the military. And it also would leave a residual of, in this country that would far transcend what happened to Truman in China. It was going to be horrible if we didn't at least do this somewhat right. You can't just turn your back on an ally. I mean, what does that say to the rest of them? How would you like to be, you know, Australia or Thailand having a mutual defense pact with the United States, very same as South Vietnam, and then all of a sudden they decide, whoops, this isn't fun, I'm leaving. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they're big issues, and the Democrats were not talking about those issues. Mm-hmm. And Nixon was, and Nixon had a hell of a lot of experience compared to the rest of them. And so, yeah, I was a huge Nixon supporter insofar as he's the guy that's going to do it right, and we need him. So I voted for him, and I was very pleased that he won, and he bore that trust out. I'm convinced had Dick Nixon not been president of the United States, we would have gone into, this country would have gone into such mass chaos and then recriminations, and it would have been so horrible. I think we would not have been a world power within 5 years. I just think it would have been that devastating because people were polarizing so badly. And for all the things that Nixon did wrong, and they're pretty well documented, the things he did right tend to get overlooked.
Well, were you... I assume that you were not disappointed when Johnson announced he was not going to run for election.
Not at all.
Okay.
You know, he was obviously so overwhelmed with what was going on. You know, I think it was a good move on his part because I honestly don't know that his party would have nominated him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you got back to Vietnam. I'm sorry. One more pre-second tour question. When you were with fellow soldiers at Fort Benning or going through training at Fort Rucker, how much did you guys commiserate, talk about your experiences in Vietnam and Southeast Asia? How much did that, and how did that experience help you, if at all?
I mean, geez, that's all we talked about.
Okay.
Well, that and women.
Okay.
Because that was so much part of our life. How did it help you? Well, it was nice to have somebody to talk to us about because you sure couldn't talk to civilians about it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them didn't care, and if they did, it was usually kind of sad.
Okay. Yeah.
Quite misplaced. We're behind you 100%, boys.
Good.
Thank you. My personal nightmare goes on, but glad to know you care.
But having that kind of an environment where you could feel comfortable and safe talking about your experiences, knowing that someone or the people around you could understand them, could identify and relate directly to them based on their own experiences, that did help in some ways?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it helps an awful lot because there's an instant understanding. I mean, I don't care where the guy served. Sure, you go through a little of that unit. You know, my dog's better than your dog. But you know, scratch the surface. We're all soldiers, and we all went through it. It was, and everybody had gone, and those who hadn't, there were damn few of them. Most everybody had been there at least once, and if you hung around too much longer, you were going to go there again.
Well, let's see here. When you did go back, if you would, first of all, did you know what unit you were going to be assigned to?
Yes. And actually, I did. I was the first OH-58 IP in country.
Okay.
And I knew... Well, no, I take that back. No, I didn't know going over where I was going to. I was just assigned to 90th replacement.
And what was the trip like over for the second tour? Was it different, the same?
It was horrible.
How so?
Well, it was horrible because, you know, I wasn't naive anymore. I knew I was what I was going back to, although I really didn't. It never occurred to me things had changed over there radically. And, you know, I was leaving my wife and my children, and, you know, it was depressing. And it was scary.
How many children did you have at that point?
Two, by my previous marriage.
Right.
And my wife and I had gotten the children from my sisters, and so she was going to have the kids while I was in Vietnam. So it wasn't happy, you know. In a sense, there's almost just, and people talk about target fixation for pilots when you're bombing, you know, if you're not careful, you can get so fixated on the dive down on the target and getting just the right angle and everything that if you're not careful, you won't pull out.
Right.
And I think when you're faced with a situation where you have multiple tours back to a combat area, you get fixated on that emotionally because you can't get over it because you got to go back. So you're trapped in limbo. It dominates your thinking, and you can't get away from it. It's always waiting for you. It's like the specter that refuses to go away. It's always in the background of everything. And so whatever time you're away from there, I mean, this is why Fort Benning was such an intense place, because everybody is doing this horrible, slow dance of imitation life, and it's not life at all because death is waiting, just sitting over there in the corner. It hasn't gone away. You can't get over your experiences because you got to go back and have some more. So you stay stuck, and then going, when you start back over again, you have to really get yourself under phenomenal control because you know what you're going back to. And you don't know if you're going to walk away from this one either. I mean, you've already tempted fate once. Now you want to do it again. Okay. So you go back and you spend that whole 21 hours trying not to think about it, but of course it's always there. And you don't know if you've seen your loved ones for the last time or not. And then, you know, you get into these idle thoughts while you're driving along at 37,000 feet. You look at all the khaki uniforms in the airplane, and you think, damn, I wonder how many of these guys are going to make it back alive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
How did these experiences affect your religious beliefs, if at all?
Well, I was no longer a Catholic, which, that hurt. It was...
Because
my basic belief in God had never changed. My basic belief in my, I would say, the keeper parts of the religion. The keeper parts are especially for Catholics, because at that time, even though Vatican II had come along and supposedly changed things, it hadn't changed shit for me because I was in the Army, and so, you know, we're cloistered. We don't know a whole bunch of stuff that's going on, but for me, I mean, you know, the meat on Friday and the mandatory Sunday masses, that's not important, but God is important, and you know, the Trinity and that sort of stuff, yeah, that never goes away. And you know, I pray all the time, both tours, and I still pray to this day. That hasn't changed one bit. But I didn't have, shall we say, the core that you have from going to the mass. I mean, I didn't go anymore because I didn't feel welcome. That was a me thing. That had nothing to do with the church or anything else. So that was Bill making his break from Catholicism. But yeah, I took God with me.
Did the ever-present nature of death in Vietnam and in war, did it change your outlook on life and on death? And if so, how? Is it even possible to articulate it?
I give you my favorite saying. You've never lived until you've almost died. For those who've had to fight for it, life has a flavor the protected will never know. This business of dying becomes pretty sophisticated because on one hand, you don't give a shit. I mean, you get to the point of where you're so sick of being terrified that you don't care. You do care, but you don't care, and that's the cross on which you're hung. You have a lot that you want to live for. You have a lot that you feel that you can contribute and want to do. But on the other hand, you understand perfectly the old Lakota saying, it's a good day to die. And you get into that mode. That if we're going to die, then, hey, screw it. Today's the day. Let's go. Rock and roll, baby. My job is to take as many of them as I can, and if they get me, so be it. Then there are other times when you're in the other mode, and death is so tangible. You can smell it. You can taste it, and it holds you in its arms, and it never lets you go, because if you struggle against it, it'll consume you. Life gets really precious, and every time that you are able to save lives, sometimes even the enemy, if that makes sense, then you win. There are other times when, yes, there's killing to be done, and you do it, and that's the sad time. On my first tour, I used to get exhilarated and get a rush, and then later on I realized there's nothing to be excited about here. This is not a game. This is, you know, we're not up 3-2 in the top of the ninth. This is humanity that you're toying with, and you have no business being here. These are things that belong to a higher power. You're mucking about in territory that's very dangerous. I don't know if that answers your question. I don't know if there is an answer.
I think you did.
Okay.
When you got to Vietnam for the second tour, what month was this?
November 17th, 1969.
November 17th, 1969. Okay. What were the immediate differences or changes that you noticed about the war and what was going on in Vietnam now?
The enlisted men walking around with no hats and the John Lennon glasses and the peace signs and marijuana leaves on everything. And
the counterculture had arrived in Vietnam.
excuse me, this is like in a Superman comic where you end up in Bizarro World. Well, what happened to the army? Isn't the army here? It was a shock, to say the least. Well, there's a shock being back, because no matter what you think, you have forgotten a lot. And then all of a sudden, you're right back in it. And then you look around, and here are these really bizarre creatures. And there's no other way to describe it. And you think, oh, my God, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Well, what's going on is drugs have arrived in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And the crusade is over. This isn't a crusade anymore. This is a slave ship. And everybody's supposed to be pulling at their oars, but no. A lot of guys are not doing anything. They're just putting in time. A lot of racial issues, things that, well, I realized real quick. Number one, I had made a serious error in judgment. And number two, this was going to be a long, long year. The difference is we're there. But it takes you a moment to, you know, there's sort of a period of time where you're catching up to being there, and then you keep looking around, you don't see much that's familiar. So that was bad. And then talking to the guys who were getting ready to go home, because of the 90th replacement, you had those who were coming in and those who were going out. And so he had... The guys who were going out said, hey, man, it's changed. Changed a lot from when I first got here, and you'll see it. The enlisted men are doing drugs. There's a lot of racial tension. The officer corps is... they've changed, too. We're not a team anymore. We're more like a bunch of guys kind of going through a thing. Hmm. And that scared me worse than anything, because you could see that there were some phenomenal leadership challenges that were evidencing themselves that were not being addressed. Mm-hmm. So real quick, within a day or two, and of course I needed a shower, like, badly. God, I needed a shower. Those pilots of the 229th wet my wings down. We had this party the night before I left for Vietnam, and they dumped all their drinks on me about 4 o'clock in the morning while Rick Beaver gave the aviators toast. I was so drunk, I went to bed, got up about 3 hours later, and I'm hungover anyway, and off I go to Vietnam with all this booze plastered all over me. Because I'd overslept, didn't have time for a shower. It was bad. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was not a real happy camper. And then when I got to the 90th Replacement Company, I found out I was being sent to the 11th Armored Cav. I wanted to go back to the 1st Cav. Okay. But the 11th Cav picked me up, even though I tried to pull some strings, and then I was told no. The 11th Cav has dibs on the first OH-58IP in country, and you're it. I said, okay. So I went up to the 11th Cav.
Okay. So we've been talking for over an hour. Let's go ahead and take a break.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah, I will call you back in about 10 minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
See you in a bit.